I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold. With the unending carousel of disasters and crises we face today, it can be difficult to imagine a better future. We need transformative thinkers that can see beyond our current state to build something new. How can we create transformative thinkers, though? Through transformative education.
In this episode, we're speaking with Anne Snick, creator of The Young Person's Guide to the Future. Anne's educational framework empowers people to think about big problems from a systems perspective and see new and better futures that might have seemed impossible to many. We'll let Anne elaborate.
Hi, my name is Anne Snick. I'm living in Belgium. My background is in philosophy of education, and I am really passionate about working with young people to create a brighter future, because we're now living in kind of scary times. I know the window of the time window we have to change course is shrinking rapidly. So I'm really passionate about exploring new ways how we can learn together as a society to shift to a new system. So I'm sort of experimenting with that, and I like to do it inside the universities, because they are really the gatekeeper for young people's education. But at the same time, I'm adding a layer to the university education, which is transmitting knowledge, transmitting science, adding that layer of feeling empowered to co-create solutions for a brighter future. Is what I really makes me tick.
That's so awesome. So the name of your curriculum is...
It's not a curriculum, let's be clear. It's a learning framework.
A learning framework.
It's called The Young Person's Guide to the Future. And The Young Person's Guide to the Future, if I can say something about that, is really a metaphor. And what inspired me for that was, not all young people know that, but when Martin Luther King would have said, "I have a nightmare," I don't think he would have mobilized so many people. But he said, "I have a dream." And he mobilized so many people, and he brought about so much change. So there again, it's not the scientific facts that are a nightmare. You know, so many people are in jail or so many, you know. It's the dream of contributing to having a vision of a nicer world that mobilizes people. So that was my inspiration to say, like, sustainability. If you look at sustainability education today, it's mostly about the nightmare. It's mostly the scientific facts of the where we're overshooting and polluting and all that kind of thing. And that is good. I mean, you need to know the facts. We're not blind. But at the same time, if education is to prepare young children for a future, giving them the facts is scaring them and is making them depressed. And it's not empowering them to go for it. So I thought, let's try that out. Let's try out if we can do the same thing. You know, I have a dream for education. So I went to the university. There was a program that allowed actors from society, like you have an NGO, say, in development cooperation, and you want to figure out what motivates people to buy fair trade coffee in the supermarket. You can go and you get I would like a team of students that help me to figure out. And then for a year, a team of students from different disciplines will help you too. So I used that opportunity and I went to the university and I said, I would like a team of students to figure out with me if we could change approach higher education in a different way. Because I have a dream for educating young people, but of course I need the young people to join me there. I mean, I cannot do it for them. It's they have to test it out and try it out and see if it works. So we use the metaphor of the young person's guide to the future, like a travel guide, because it's a metaphor, but at the same time, it's a framework. Because a travel guide, say if you'd have whatever, the Lonely Planet Guide to Mongolia, it does not tell you what you will experience in Mongolia. It does not tell you what you must experience in Mongolia. It tells you what you can experience in Mongolia, if you know where to look and how to behave. So that means the country that we're going to, the future in this case, it's described in a probabilistic way. There is no science that says how it will be. There's no science that says how it must be. But there's a lot of wisdom that says how it could be if we know how to behave and how to look for it.
I love the metaphor. It kind of reminds me of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. That's what
well, you know, it also has has the playful part and the it's fun. It's fun to go there and to imagine how beautiful it could be.
Yes, yeah. What's the thing you always bring? You always bring a blanket or is it a towel? I can't remember. In the Hitchhiker's Guide, you always have to have the towel with you or something like that. That's very funny.
Yeah.
And it's also kind of a quantum physics kind of quality to it. You're looking at multiple possibilities of a future and just picking a path and exploring that path.
Exactly. So, you know, that links to the work that I've also been doing. I'm looking at higher education here, but I'm also looking at science, responsible research and innovation, it's called in Europe. And it's how can science respond to the big challenges we have today, knowing that many of those challenges were brought about by science. You know, we have engineers that developed or that made the Industrial Revolution happen, and look what we have now. We have people who developed beautiful invention like antibiotics. In the lab, it was proven to, you know, with 90% security that it would improve your health. So with that one parameter, you know, evaluate the impact on one patient, it was rolled out into society, believing that if you do what you see in the lab, if you do A, then B happens. So if you do more than A, then more of B will happen, more health will come. And then all of a sudden, we got a tipping point, which where the World Health Organization says that antibiotics are the single biggest threat to human health ever. And it was human made. Without science, it would never have, you know, we would not have had that. So that is where I believe science also has to shift to a different paradigm. The current science was established in the 17th century when Newton and Descartes discovered that there were regularities in nature that you could express in mathematical formulas. And so they imagined nature like a clockwork, like a machine that you can take apart, you can tweak the subparts and put it back together again. But of course, nature is life, it's evolving, it's dynamic, it's not clockwork, we know that now. And the more we tweak it, the more it might, you know, start going in directions that we have not foreseen. So that is complexity. And we have more recent science, and you know, this
which is actually the situation we are currently in, right? It's going into directions we kind of try to predict, but really, it's kind of unpredictable what's going to happen. Right. And so if I understand you correctly, you were saying with all this unprediction, what's coming, the complexity we are already in, we have to adjust science and the way we learn accordingly, which cannot be in silos. It cannot be this kind of linear learning process. We have to develop a sort of a different tool set for dealing with that complexity in future.
I think the reason why, you know, even the World Academy of Art and Science, they say, you know, you see companies changing, you see politicians launching green deals. The most conservative sector in society is science, believe it or not. And so what is interesting is we have more recent sciences that say, wait a minute, everything is interconnected, like quantum physics, say, like, you know, this subject-object separation.
Right. It
doesn't really exist. And we also, you know, nature is out there and we can study it and tweak it. And we're as a subject, we're in the ivory tower. And if society dies, we will still be in the ivory tower discovering absolute truths or certain truths that we can express in mathematics. So they're certain. Of course, it's not like that. So what you see, you know, when the universities were established, it was this mechanistic and separatist worldview was dominant, or the paradigm was dominant. So the entire architecture of the universities is built on that. It's in separate faculties. Mm-hmm. Natural sciences are in one corner of the city, and social sciences and humanity are a different campus, and biomedical sciences are still a different campus. And they don't talk with each other anymore. You know, they don't even understand each other's language anymore. It's totally, as you say, it's totally siloed. And that is the drama. And the whole system, of course, there is progress within your paradigm. You can get more and more and more specialized, but that does not allow you to step back and foresee what you have in your lab. You can control the parameters. You say, I'm just going to control, you know, manipulate one parameter, but to know the impact of that, I have to control all the other parameters. And then we say, when we roll it out, it's there a famous Latin expression for it is called ceteris paribus. We assume that all the other parameters will remain the same. Well, guess what we've discovered with the antibiotics? That they are not remaining the same. That it antibiotics infiltrate in the groundwater, it affects our immune system, it has an impact on the culture because now we all expect a quick fix. You know, it starts, you know, having rebound effects in many, many cultural, economic, etc. You know, we want our livestock to get antibiotics because it increases the profits, and we need money. You know, money is another parameter. Mm-hmm. So that is where science is now saying, like, earth science, like, everything is interconnected. We're in the Anthropocene. Humans have an impact on the earth system, and also quantum physics. You know, on that level too, we said, like, you know, these separatist linear mechanistic rules are false. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. It's just a probability. It could be like that. You know, the metaphor of the travel guide. And then if you look at astrophysics, it's even more extreme, because there we see that the universe, after the Big Bang, you would think that the expansion of the universe finally slows down, you know, as the explosion wears out. What we see is that it speeds up. So there we know that the laws that we see in the physics domain, in this, you know, in this area where we think we can tweak and control, well, we can at a certain scale, they're not applicable to the bigger system, not on the astrophysical level, not on the quantum physical level, but most of the sciences are stuck in the level of, you know, the mechanistic physics, you know. You know, even medicine is mostly, you know, treated like what chemical can we give the patient, not like how can we create a healthy.
In our society.
Yeah, I mean, in Western. Yeah. I'm working here. Yeah, a very, very good
remark.
It's
really interesting, yeah. Because what it's saying is we're kind of stuck. We are stuck in a world of our own invention.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And yet, we're not sure how to. It's so complex at this point. We're not sure how our behavior could change that system to get us out of that.
Well, I'm not so pessimistic about that. We start understanding, because as Stephanie, as you said, absolutely correctly, this was the Western metaphor. And, you know, in this, we have said, like, you know, in our religion, we also say, like, we are created in God's image and nature was given to us as a resource, as, you know, we could use it. So we have this, and God is not like an animistic, it's not the holy tree or the holy mountain, he's some abstract transcendent personality. So if we are in his image, we're also not part of nature. We're on top of it and in control of it. But that, of course, is a religion. It's a belief. It's not a scientific fact.
Fallacy number one.
Yeah, and it is embedded, you know, look at economics. They say they treat nature as a resource, assuming that, you know, endless growth will be, you know, the nature will assume absorb endlessly the waste that we produce and produce endlessly. And now we're running into, we have depleted the buffers and we have filled the oceans with filth, and now we start understanding that no, it's not like that, this mechanistic world. But a shift of paradigm is very, very difficult, and it's mainly in university, you know, they're so afraid of being caught up by a false truth, fake truth, that they sort of like hold on to, but these are the facts, these are the numbers, these are the maths. Yeah, that's true, but your maths are only a little part of the bigger picture, and you also have to look at what you call externalities. They're not externalities anymore, they're boomeranging back in our face. So let's zoom out and let's go to the complex systems thinking and connecting all the pieces of the puzzle together and start seeing how they interact with each other and how they may have adverse effects that you did not foresee if you looked only at one parameter. But as soon as you start looking at more parameters, you start understanding more the complexity of it and the probabilistic nature of it. And that's where human agency is incredibly important. If we understand the interconnection, we're going to be much more prudent. And since it's difficult to change the paradigm, you know, the professors are stuck. If they start saying what I say, their career will stop. We don't want to lose those people. You know, we want scientists. So I'm not changing the curriculum. I'm just adding a layer of learner-driven, co-creative, visionary learning to that.
Yes. I have a question for you, though. You know, I think you're pointing to something that kind of has happened before in human history recently, which is the 60s. Let's just go back to the 60s. You mentioned Martin Luther King. But there were a lot of questioning of the status quo during that period of time. On sexuality, on, you know, think the education, every, on commerce, every single kind of basic standard of society was put into question in that period of time. And yet, fast forward, the time since then, the 40, 50 years since then, we've burned more carbon than we did in the entire history of humankind, right? So how do we create a sustainable questioning of the paradigm? Like I hear what you're saying and I understand the movement, and it's very exciting to think about, you know, a student-centered paradigmatic change.
Yeah, so I call it learner-centered.
Learner-centered,
yeah, because even
student is a is
teachers old, can old you know professors can also join and say we start learning again.
Okay, yeah, I think you're really onto something. You know, education is kind of the way in which we form ourselves, but how do we keep it going? Because a student graduates and then they have to get a job because they have to survive, and then they are stepping into the old system immediately and all the parameters change.
Okay, if I had the answer to that, you could give me the Nobel Prize, right? I use metaphors. I use the metaphor of the tanker. A tanker, I don't know, you know, you can't stop it, or it takes, you know, 3 days for it to stop if it has a so. And many people are trying to change the tanker, you know, looking at the... What I see is that these innovators that I just talked about, like agroecology, community currencies, car sharing initiatives, they're not shifting the tanker. They're just putting out little lifeboats and say, like, I'm going to find my own course to, you know, to navigate the stormy waters. I'm going to try a different track because that track is leading straight into the iceberg. And of course, these niches are way too vulnerable. You know, you can't survive alone in the big sea, in the big ocean. So my hope is to reinforce that movement of people creating lifeboats and young people knowing that the lifeboats are there and might want to join that movement, not to create the next tanker, of course not, but to create a fleet of interconnected
of little boats. Yeah.
Well, different boats. You know, some boats might be a little bit bigger. Some boats might have a sail. Some might have a different design, and some might be like, oh, there's a temporary storm here. This kind of boat is better prepared for that. Let's shift to that one, or let's give the lead to this one, or one boat has capsized. Let's take the passengers on board. Other boats. So this idea of this resilient fleet that is big enough to sort of, like, you know, create a real alternative is what you could also call it an ecosystem. You know, this is a monoculture. The tanker is the monoculture of one economic model that is extractive. And in the 60s, we had not hit the boundaries yet. We could still believe, you know, that we could go there, and that it was. And it's also, I think, since there was so little alternative at the real alternatives at the time, it was difficult for people to say, like, I'm going to step in a different boat, because there was no
it's
other boat.
It's also pretty inconvenient, you know, to say, oh, let's just change. Let's do things differently. I think it's out of convenience that we have been stuck in this kind of, what you say, ongoing extractive system. And it's
because there was not really an alternative. There was in the minds, and there was in the spirit and in the fantasy, like, okay, you know, we're gonna break up the cobblestones and we'll go back to the street underneath the sand and the beach underneath the cobblestones.
Yeah.
But until somebody starts breaking up the cobblestones, you know,
gonna keep using the roads.
Yeah, you're gonna stay on the road. So that is why it's really fantastic that we have this entire movement of, call it social innovation, citizen cooperatives, more and more and more people are saying.
I really like this image of yours with the tanker and the little boats. It kind of also leads to the question, is change coming through disaster, or does it come through design? Like, will we have enough, like, lifeboats prepared for everyone, or is the tanker going to sink and then, you know, whoever survives?
I don't know. There's another metaphor that I use. It's the big, big, big old sick tree in the forest that casts a shadow over everything and sap, you know, takes away the saps, you know, what you call it, the life force of everything around it. And that tree is very, very sick, but because it is so sick, there's you know, now some light is coming into the forest, and that is where new plants are coming up. a diversity of new plants, and we call them maybe bad herbs, but maybe they, you know, they can start working together.
Right.
So I think the big tree will crash, and it must crash because it's making everybody sick. It's making everything sick. But of course, the crashing will hurt a lot. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm really afraid of that. I'm not saying, oh, we'll peacefully step over into the lifeboat and then let the tanker sink. I think it's gonna be very, very painful. But at the same time, if we already nourish that little, you know, these little plants coming up, that this new ecosystem coming up, and tell the student, like, when it crashes, you know, I think education should not be about sustaining the old tree. It should be about nourishing the new ecosystem.
I think that's a very important distinction.
Yes.
Very, very important.
Yes.
I think you are the one who said, looking at the goal and what stops us from reaching that goal. Well, the goal isn't to save the existing system.
No, because we now know it's killing us.
The goal is to save life on Earth, right? Including humans, but also not including humans, you know.
Including the other than humans.
Yes.
Yeah, other being than humans, yeah. Yeah, and that is the ecosystem. You know, if you look at nature, it's amazing how quickly nature can rebound, unless we've gone to a certain, you know, tipping point where a species, once it's gone, it will not come back. And there's another thing that I wanted to say, again, going back to your remark, Stephanie, is that this Western paradigm of, you know, mechanistic separating nature into its separate parts and putting humans apart is totally different from the indigenous knowledge system, where they did not have labs, but the forest or wherever their ecosystem was their lab. They would try a plant and see how it heals or doesn't heal or in what conditions. So they did have science systems. It has been described by the first colonizers, like in South Africa, they really had science systems, but not in labs, but in, call it, mm-hmm, the living lab or the real, mm-hmm, lab of it. But then we came, you know, the Europeans came, and we said, like, oh, but that, you know, they cannot put it in mathematical formulas, or they can't control their parameters. So that knowledge is just voodoo. It's primitive, you know, it's. And so we imposed our knowledge system on their more holistic and interconnected and systemic and complexity-based knowledge systems. We call that indigenous knowledge. And it's not just indigenous as in people in the south or local communities in the forest. It's also our indigenous knowledge. You know, when I work with scientists, I ask them, give me an analysis of what happened with the antibiotics crisis. And they all come up with, it has to do with biophysical changes, you know, the groundwater, the mutation of the bug, etc. It has to do with economic changes or economic factors, you know, the profit drive of the pharma, the agro industry, and it has to do with cultural. You know, we want a quick fix. We want to control illness. We don't support illness anymore. So they all know that it is all interconnected. They know it. And then the next question is, if you know that everything is interconnected, we all know that, why do we accept a science system that does not let you take that into account? Why are we colonized by this 17th century?
Well, it's more convenient, no? And it's also, I think, natural for us to kind of categorize everything.
But I think indigenous knowledge also categorizes, but they categorize in a different way. They will say, like, if I have a book, I will think of the tree's life that was sacrificed for the book, and I will express my gratitude to the tree. That is a way of, you know, linking the paper of my book, and I'm grateful to have the book. I'm, mm-hmm, not saying I'm going to save the life of the tree and stay illiterate. I'm happy to have the book, but at the same time, I pay tribute to the tree that gave his or her life for my book, and I express that gratitude. And then the tree becomes like part of your family. And if your family gives you a gift, you're not going to throw it away. You're not going to spit on it. You're not going to say, give me the next gift. You're not going to exploit the giver. You're going to return that gift. And that is where indigenous knowledge is so different from Western knowledge. And part of the Young Person's Guide to the Future is, what would a decolonized future look like? I had a team of students working on that this year. What we see, or what they learned by reading books, by discussing, by visiting places, is that, like in the First Nations in America, in, what do you call it? Abiyala, you know, the First Nations that lived there, they had certain rules for taking from nature. Like, if you find a plant, you never take the first one. It might be the only one. So if you take that one, it's gone. You only take the second one, or, you know, the further one. Secondly, you never take more than half, because you want the population to remain big enough that it can come back. And then thirdly, you give something back. You know, you restore something to, in return to what has changed. And a very interesting story that really an eye-opener for me is that there was a discussion. It was about sweet grass. It's a kind of grass that is very important for their both economically and also ritually, because humans, you know, spirituality and the physical are interconnected. Not in the Western world, but there it is. And so some of the nations, they pull out the grass with the roots and everything, while others cut it. So there was a discussion, like, which one is better for the population of the grass, the cutting or the pulling. So this author, Robin Wall Kimmerer, who wrote the book Braiding Sweetgrass, she's a First Nations wise woman, but she's also a scientist, Western scientist. So she had a PhD student developing three plots. In one plot, she had the sweetgrass being pulled out according to the Indian rules, you know, never take more than half, etc., etc. Second plot, they cut the grass. And in the third plot, they didn't touch the grass. Humans stay out, you know, what we call natural reserves, supposing that nature will be better off if we stay away from it. Now, the result was that between the first two plots, the cutting and the pulling, there was no difference. But the third plot was the worst of all.
Interesting.
It didn't, you know, because it was managed by humans, you know, they pulled out, you know, the weeds in the middle so that there was space for the younger plants to come up. I can't tell you the technical
details.
So
we can do good.
But the thing is, because Western approach to nature is just for efficiency, we'll just go with a bulldozer over it and, you know, clear cut the whole field. And then we say there's only one solution, and it is to stay out as humans, because we humans, you Western humans, we destroy nature, we extract it, we exploit it. So then the only solution is to stay away. But indigenous people, they return, they're part, they take care of the family, because the family takes care of them. And so returning to that indigenous knowledge is one of the chapters, or one of the routes to the future.
Mm-hmm. So we have come across people who just feel overwhelmed when they start feeling the mass enormity of what we're facing. That it's interconnected makes it even bigger in some respects. And, you know, I think even for ourselves, we focus on... We like to use the term imaginal cells, right? This is a Barbara Marx Hubbard. She was a philosopher who basically thinks we as humans are co-creating our future as a species, and each person who's looking into that future is an imaginal cell. And when we all come together, we create the new human. And this is very apt for what you're talking about, right?
I have to read that book. It's like exactly.
You're creating imaginal cells, learners who are, are engaged in what is the future for us. What's possible? What can we do? And I think it's so empowering for some that are already kind of in that paradigm of, or in the mode of questioning things and thinking about, what if this didn't exist, or what if that didn't exist, or what if something else existed?
Yes.
But for so many people, it's just terrifying at the same time.
Well,
Have you come across that?
Yeah, that's why I leave the space for students to be afraid and to say, like, I'm not ready to go there. I compare it sometimes with the grieving process. You know, the old world, the big tree is dying, the tanker is sinking, the world as we know it will stop. It will not go on. We already, you know, we're facing the end of it. So that is a grieving process. And the first phase of a grieving process is, it can't be true. I lost a son. I know exactly what it is. Cannot be true. I'm in the wrong movie. Go back.
Mm. Right.
The second phase is anger. God, you know, what if I had done something different? We start negotiating. Like, if I green my growth a little bit, or if I use renewable energy, will it then be okay? You know, it's the anger, you know, and negotiating, trying to win the... And then the third phase is acceptance. Like, let go, you know, let go. And only then accept that death is part of life. You know, that life is not just life. It's a cycle of life. Life and renewal of life, which means death, but the death is also going back to the process, which can then materialize again in new new matter. And so after that, you can start building the new world. And so, as I said, I think a lot of the like Fridays for Future, Extinction Rebellion, school strikes, they're in the anger phase, which is good. And many students are also in the denial phase. They don't want to hear about sustainability. They want politically neutral courses. You know, they're going to be an engineer and they want to believe that nanotechnology is going to save the world. And I'll never say, yes, but you must understand that it's not true, because it's a grieving process. And if somebody would have said, Anne, you know, don't deny, you know, you can't say it's not true. I kept the coat of my son hanging on the hanger for, I think, a year, because one day he might come back. You know, I was, I remained for a long time, part of me remained in the denial. And if somebody would have told me, like, now you must be reasonable and believe that it's not true, it was not going to help me in my grieving process.
Yes.
So you need the space. That's what I mean with the emotion.
Very profound.
Create
yes.
the space where you, yeah, it's very tough, it's difficult.
But we also need the language.
Also, yeah.
You know?
And the rituals, the rituals to support each other and to, but I also notice that if you show already, look, there is a new world coming, it facilitates the grieving process.
Right.
It facilitates to say, like, oh, we're losing the big tree, but oh, look, what beautiful flowers are coming up there. And well, but still, we're attached to the tree. And I, you know, but there's something else. It makes it less scary. So that's why the first thing, the thing that the students do, I try, I mean, that would be, if I'd have to sort of like, you know, write out the manual, I would say the first thing you do is look at the documentary The Man, the documentary Tomorrow, or other documentaries that
show,
you know,
hope.
Show the, you know, Kiss the Ground is another one.
Yes.
You know, there's many of those documentaries. Go look there first. Go to the
Gold podcast, by the way.
Oh, who's not?
Yeah, well, whatever, you know, listen to the podcast. You know that it's something new is coming. And then we're like, where are we now and how can we get there?
Yes.
You know, write that guide to the future. You can write it. We're not there yet, you know, and we don't know how to get there. That's why we need to write the traveler's guide. The traveler's guide is to help you out.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm very serious actually with language, because and this is why I love your, I guess you can call it methodology.
Yeah, that would be okay.
Framework.
Or methodological framework is what I usually call it.
Methodological framework. Yeah. Because it prepares you, it just doesn't shock you. And I know of a couple of like papers, publications, which are so shocking, you know, to especially young people's, I'd say it now, souls, that they decide to disconnect completely. And that is not the right way to go. So this, I really love your process and preparing, like step for step, and accepting and grieving. Everything is fine.
Let's zoom out a little bit.
Okay.
Whenever I come across someone who's speaking about a future and possibility, and you know, there's almost always a sense of a backlash. Right? The old system wants to hold on to itself until its dying gasp. And today in the world, I mean, I'm just now asking you as a person, not as an educator or anything. But today in the world, we see really hard line positioning of going back to the old system worldwide, in very conservative, autocratic kind of movements, you know, against women, against LGBT, against, you know, race differences.
Against democracy.
Do you see this in the context of what you're doing as kind of just that, a dying gasp of a dinosaur dying? How do you process today's situation?
I haven't really reflected on that so much, because for my own mental health, I focus on the things that are hopeful, and I'm not focusing on the fights that are happening. It depresses me too much, so I'm focusing on what's happening that makes me hopeful, and passing that on to learners, and hoping that when it comes to it, when the thing really crashes, you know, in this last final gasp, you know. This last fire-spitting dragon, it will convince more people to say, like, oh, but there is an alternative. There is an alternative. What keeps us from going there? But yeah, I mean, this maybe this is already the pain of the old tree starting to crush down on people and say, like, no, you're not gonna, you know, I am the powerful tree. But eventually, I mean, the planet is what the planet is. I mean, they can believe that holding on to their power will make the planet hold on to life, but it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. So I'm really looking at, you know, even if it crashes in a painful way and we can't keep that from happening, and it's going to be a lot of suffering, at least we know where to look to rebuild a new system, not rebuild the old system.
Yes.
You know, like what happened in the corona crisis. You know, let's, you know, build a new normal. Well, we're just rebuilding the old normal, because it takes time, but also because, you know, most scientists or most the press talks about, you know, are we still, is the growth good? You know, will there be growth? Is there, you know, we're losing our purchasing power. And I'm saying, is there well-being? You know, is there, look where it's happening. Even without purchasing power, people help each other out and you see communities thriving. And so I'm focusing more on that. And I don't know if it's, you know, the dying of the dinosaur or the crashing of the tree. I don't know. I'm not very helpful in that one. I'm not sure.
Well, we just got to keep making more imaginal cells, I guess. More inspiring stories, people working on a future that's different.
Is there anything you would like to say as a last sentence?
Specifically to our listeners.
Yeah.
Something, some nugget of wisdom you'd like to impart.
A bucket? We already had a bucket of wisdom.
A nugget.
I would really want to say, it is happening and you can be part of that hopeful story. Just know that you have a choice today and you don't have to sink the ship or cut the tree, but stay, you know, don't stay stuck in it and come out every now and again to nourish the little new ecosystem that is growing and reconnect with it. It will make you happy and, you know, very grateful if you do.
So we heard a lot of metaphors.
Metaphors.
We heard a lot of metaphors.
Anna's really brilliant at making a metaphor, and I think it's a powerful tool to communicate pretty complicated things.
Yeah, in the world where we seem to be able to not agree anymore, or let's say where we are on the left or right side of the room, and everything seems so black and white, I think, indeed, it is a wonderful way of maybe pulling people back on the table and say, hey, this is just a story.
Yeah.
Where can we agree on? How do you see this? And I mean, I like the ship, you know, the Titanic thing. I love the tree actually better than the Titanic. But anyway, let's talk about this a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think metaphors are very powerful. I mean, you know, I like to think of planet Earth as kind of a lifeboat that we're all on together. But I also think Anne is very careful to craft her vision of the future in terms of really new transformative ideas that don't necessarily destroy the old system, but buttress the old system in making it something new. You know, like the old tree stays, but it feeds the young trees. And rather than steering the Titanic away from the iceberg, you add multiple little ships that can easily navigate. And it's really refreshing to think about the future that way, I think, you know. And also just the whole idea of thinking about the future as a travel guide, like a mysterious right. destination.
The title right? itself, yes. This it's almost like a logbook.
Right.
Where it's in a suggestion. It's not that you have to do this. You have to go to this restaurant. It's a suggestion, like pick what you like.
Yeah, try on different lenses of travel and think about the future from different angles. And
right, like the Lonely Planet, which obviously our planet is no longer lonely. But it's an inspiration of where could I go next and what's the future looking like and what do I pick, what interests me, which matches my talents, and how can I be of service and use.
Yeah. I imagine it must be really fun to take her classes.
Let's do it. We are an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Brought to you by Game Changers, www.gamechangers.world. For the price of one latte per month, you can help fuel our work and keep our content untainted by commercial interests.
For more exclusive content, join us on patreon.com or click donate on potofgold.world.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul. I'm Mel Wymore.
And I'm Stephanie Overbeck.
Thanks for listening.